Hello, and thank you for joining us for the inaugural broadcast of The Beautiful Game. There are as many podcasts about the game of soccer as there are teams and leagues in the world, if not more. And we're not here to try to be just another podcast. We're hoping to be here for the new fan of the game we love. Maybe you got pulled in by the U.S. men's national team watching World Cup games. Maybe your city got a soccer franchise and built a stadium, and there's a lot of excitement around the sport. And maybe you just started playing pickup soccer after many years away. However you got here, we are probably as excited as you are about soccer. One of the things that we notice is that there's so often references and assumptions made that go over the head of the new soccer fan. What's 4-4-2 versus 4-3-3? What's the soccer pyramid? Transfer windows? Loans? What are the teams that matter around the world? Who's coming up? So The Beautiful Game aims to cover Champions League, Barclays Premier League, Major League Soccer, and World Cup football with healthy doses of interviews with the most knowledgeable people around. Our first season lays the groundwork for covering these topics by having long-form interviews with some people who have made soccer a major part of their lives. With me today are David Avery. Thanks for being here. David.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We have the representing the three-name contingent, we have Ryan Shea Horrigan.
Glad to be here as well.
And to legitimize our show by having a Euro snob, we have our Swedish guy living in America, Per Lati.
Always a pleasure.
Our first guest really needs no introduction. Greg Lawless, editor-in-chief of MLS Digital, former site director of Goal.com, erstwhile host of Waiting for Gajans and Extra Time Radio. He also is in the fifth year of organizing the annual Kicking and Screening Soccer Film Festival in New York City. I'm sure you can imagine with all of that, Greg comes from a soccer background. He played at Brown University, then for FC Avenir Bagen in Luxembourg, then for the Tampa Bay Mutiny in the original Super Draft before it was called the Super Draft in 1996. He also played for the Revs, the New England Revolution, and the Worcester Wildfire in the USISL. We might ask him about that later. He also wrote for Sports Illustrated Online from 2006 to 2010. Greg, it's a real honor to have you with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much. I'd like to, though, I want to trade to the Swedish guy, and I want to become the Euro snob.
Okay, so we have two Euro snobs
on
today's podcast. our listeners can follow Greg at Gajans on Twitter. That's G-A-E-T-J-E-N-S. And if we're purporting to be a show that talks about soccer history and background, Greg, I can't think of a better place to start than that. Who is Gajans, and why are we waiting for him?
Well, why are we waiting for him? So I took the name Gajans there for Twitter because Joe Gajan was a Haitian-American forward back in the 1940s and 50s, and he scored the goal for the United States to beat England in the World Cup in 1950, that famous 1-0 victory down in Belo Horizonte, Brazil. And he, famously afterward, he moved back to Haiti and then he disappeared. And there's really no record of what happened to him. By all accounts, he was murdered. But he was the guy back then, and everybody says he was an amazing person and even more amazing player. And so about 5 years ago when I started this podcast, Waiting for Gajans, with Adam Spangler from This is American Soccer, we said, we need another Joe Gajans to come along and produce something magical. So that was why we were waiting for him.
Well, that sounds as good. I mean, so does he have to come from Haiti? Hopefully, maybe he'll come from somewhere here.
Well, he can come from anywhere, to be perfectly honest. I really don't care, but I'd love someone to come in and score a goal in a massive victory like that. Although, you know, the U.S. does have a forward who is a Haitian-American, and so maybe he's going to go down to Brazil and do something equally spectacular. So that could be, you know what? The timing is perfect for this.
No, that would be great. And then I guess your question would be answered then, and then we change the podcast name to Waiting for This Next Guy.
We'll wait for Altidore. We'll be the next podcast for like the next 50, 60 years or so. We'll wait for Altidore.
We all know the history of MLS doesn't go back to the 1950s. So, I think this might be a good opportunity to start at the beginning. And kind of works out because I was actually originally a Tampa Bay Mutiny fan back when the team first started. I was young, so I didn't really know, you know, too much about what was going on, but, you know, I followed it as best you could in the late 90s, and then I moved out to Kansas City and became a Kansas City fan because the Mutiny were no more. But I was wondering if you could kind of tell us how MLS got started and what were the ways it was trying to ride off of what made the NASL so successful, and what did MLS want to do differently?
Sure. Before we even get to the start of MLS, I think we need to step even a little bit further back. And you can go all the way back to the 1994 World Cup. When that was awarded to the United States, one of the, I don't know if you say rules or stipulations in the World Cup being awarded to the United States was that they would start up a legitimate first division or top division league in the United States. And so very quickly, they basically put the World Cup to work to create the money, to hire the staff, to train the staff about the game and about organization of the game, so that they would be ready to launch a league as soon as the World Cup was done. Originally, they thought maybe they could get it up and running by 1993 or so, but they learned that it was going to take a little bit more, and the organization of the actual World Cup was taking more. So technically, on paper, the league then launched in 1995 as an actual corporation, I believe. The incorporation papers were signed in 1995. And then the league started play. The inaugural season was in 1996. Many of the people that worked on the organization of the World Cup in 94 moved over and did a lot around MLS. The original commissioner was Alan Rothenberg, who had been the head of the organizing committee for the World Cup. And he was the one who sort of shepherded, along with Sunil Gulati, who is now, of course, the president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, and a man named Mark Abbott were sort of the guys who were the architects of MLS back in the day. And what they did when they put it together was to say, well, what are the things that made all of the leagues before this fail? And really what made them fail, they realized, was that there was an imbalanced system where you had the big market team. Things like the New York Cosmos, think of, or the Seattle Sounders, frankly, way back in the day, they were considered a big market team because of all of the success that they had in the NASL. What made it fail was that these guys would say, I want to spend as much money as possible. The New York Cosmos spent millions and millions to bring in this incredible all-star team of world talent, but it couldn't sustain itself when you were playing against the Tulsa Rough Riders. Or, the Dallas Tornado back then really couldn't do it. They couldn't compete. And so they would end up failing. And so eventually the league folded, the NASL, the old NASL, folded in 1984 under these pressures and these weights of these teams just being unable to really make the money that could sustain them. And so in 1995, when they put MLS together, they came up with this thing called the single-entity structure. And what that meant was that all of the clubs and the owners collectively owned the league. And so that way you can share or diffuse the losses. And they knew there were going to be losses for a while when they started. And they got some great owners involved, some of them who were longtime soccer fans, some of them who were totally new to this but were big sports names. Think of a Robert Kraft in New England who had never had anything to do with soccer, but he was obviously a very important businessman in the sports world. And so they put all of this together, and they said, we can do this single entity, diffuse the losses, and someday, I imagine, everyone imagines, share the gains or the profits. And that's how they started it in 1996. And it has lasted now 18 years, which is longer than any other professional league in the history of the United States, or Canada, for that matter.
So, you know, speaking of the cosmos, you know, we all know that recently the current commissioner, Don Garber, announced that New York City would be getting another team, NYCFC. And some people are probably wondering why the league didn't bring Cosmos back, or was that even on the table? Was that even up for discussion?
Well, you know, when you look back at it right now, the New York Cosmos do exist again. So let's be very clear about that. It wasn't necessarily a question of MLS bringing the Cosmos back. They do exist. They're playing in what is currently called the NASL, the North American Soccer League, which is the second division here in the United States and Canada. And they have the Cosmos right now, they have some great aspirations to be a big club of some sort. But originally, the conversations that did happen between MLS and the Cosmos organization, you know, they just never got far enough to come to an agreement of how the Cosmos could become a team in MLS. And so Cosmos started up, they became part of the NASL, and MLS looked for another team in New York. I'm sure they were already in conversations, actually, with the other entity, which ended up being Manchester City, the big club in the Premier League in England. And that partnership worked out really well. You know, the interesting thing about the Manchester City deal is the head of Manchester City's sporting side for their sports is a guy named Ferran Soriano. And Ferran was also on the business side, and at one point, I believe, the president for FC Barcelona in Spain. He was the man about 5 years ago or 6 years ago who originally thought about maybe starting an MLS team in Miami that was connected to Barcelona. So he obviously recognizes the potential of soccer in the United States and always has. So when he was with Manchester City and the opportunity came in, he was a big part of moving Manchester City in the direction to say, hey, we should look into partnering or starting a team in MLS.
So why would a club like Manchester City come in and decide that they want to have a presence in MLS? What has MLS been doing the past few years that has been, like, really, you know, setting itself apart from other smaller leagues around the world and attracting all this international attention?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm going to take you to task on one thing you just said, which is the other smaller leagues. So we often talk about the big five in the world, right, which are right now the big five that everybody talks about are England, Spain, Germany, Italy, and then they throw France in there. I'm not sure France actually belongs in the conversation with the other four. There is even an argument that Italy no longer even belongs in the conversation with the other three, based on the fact that even not too long ago, this week, I heard the president of Juventus, Agnelli, say Italy is now a transfer league. And what they mean by, or transit league, I should say. And what he means by that basically is there are going to be good players that come up in Holland or in Africa or in South America. They'll sign in Italy, and then they'll sign for a big club somewhere else, namely Germany, England, or Spain. Which is a sad statement on where the Italian soccer league is at this point, but it's also maybe a truthful statement. So when we talk about the big leagues or the small leagues, I think that we can say now that there are basically three or four big leagues. You have then a second group of about five or six medium-sized leagues. And by those, I would say France, Turkey, Argentina, maybe, Brazil for sure. Some would argue because of the money that is included, you could put Russia in there. Mexico for sure, and I would put MLS in there. When you look at the attendance, the average attendance by league, MLS is actually 7th in the world in average attendance. So from a growth standpoint, obviously, there's something that's happening here, and it has, and I'll get back to your original question now about Manchester City. The growth of MLS, in particular in the last 4 or 5 years, basically since 2009 when the Seattle Sounders joined the league, that growth has really seen MLS in general grow in terms of its popularity in the United States and its credibility globally. I would, and maybe Per, maybe you can talk a little bit to what the perception is among the, I don't want to say Euro snobs, I would say the Europhiles that are out there of MLS. But I just returned from London, where I was at the Leaders in Sport conference, and there is an amazing amount of interest in MLS from the European soccer community, mainly because so many of those clubs over there are in financial trouble, and they look at MLS and say, that seems like a pretty decent way to go. So I think that, you know, a man like Ferran Soriano in Manchester City sees the model that's in place, recognizes that something like financial fair play is coming to Europe, and, you know, maybe we can discuss financial fair play a little later on, but basically it's a way to instill some sort of a wage cap or a salary cap in Europe. And so he says that's where the best model is in MLS, so we want to be involved in that. And, of course, they see potential for raising their brand ultimately and maybe creating some players. So that's, I hope that answers your question somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, and this is Per. So, I mean, the European league's a little bit different, and I think they look a lot towards, like I said, MLS to see how they can do to create more fair leagues, because if you're really looking at any of the top leagues in Europe, they are very top-heavy, right? There's very few leagues that are even in any way, shape, or form. MLS is somewhat even compared to almost any other league. I cannot think of anyone else that's a top-performing team. So I have hope that we get there someday in Europe as well.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about that. That was one of the things that was being discussed a lot over in London this week, where people were talking about the evenness, as you said, or the fairness of the competition, where it's so strange for us in the United States and Canada to think that you would start a season and you are really aiming. You've got your goal for 8th place or 6th place because you know you're never going to come in 1st or 2nd. But, you know, it's our culture here to automatically think, you know, everyone has a chance at the championship on opening day. And in Europe, it's just not that way. And I think that there's a growing sentiment in Europe that maybe they're sick of this. And maybe, you know, it's why Champions League is so interesting, because every club that goes into Champions League feels like it has a decent chance of actually winning that trophy.
Yeah, I'm from Sweden, and the few times we've even had a team in Champions League, I can honestly tell you that I never felt that we would have a chance. But, you know, we're also from a very small league in the have an opportunity to go to the Champions League. But even then, I mean, my team that I've always followed in England has been Blackburn, and they have been, you know, they are in the second tier league right now in the Championship. And but they also proved that with money you can buy championships.
Yeah.
Because they won the Premier League once.
Yes, they did. And what was interesting about Blackburn is they won it, and then the first thing they did was sell their best player.
They didn't have the money, though.
Yeah.
They couldn't compete because the owner was on death's bed at the moment, but he gave everything he had just to win one time in his lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, when we were talking about the, you know, fairness and the evenness of it, you know, one of the kind of talking points right now, as far as MLS is concerned, is, you know, the sort of uneven scheduling because of the different size of the two conferences. And, you know, one of the big questions that that I see a lot all the time, all over social media, is, you know, are we ever going to become a single table league? And is that even possible in a country of this size and of a league of what's growing to be a larger size?
Yeah, you know, my opinion is that, and I think this is a pretty strongly held opinion also in the offices of MLS, is that our league is sort of unique. You know, Per talked about Sweden, and the majority of the clubs in a country like Sweden or in England or Spain, at the most, it's 1 hour away on a flight. And so you don't really have the same issues of travel and time zones that you have here in the United States and Canada. You know, we were discussing when I was in, I stopped over and had a 2 days meetings with the Bundesliga in Germany, and one of the things that we were discussing was kickoff time. So when the Bundesliga goes to set up their TV rights deal and to set up everything that they're doing, they basically pick 5 kickoff times over a weekend, and those kickoff times remain the same. And you have, you know, one early one on Saturday, and then there's a joint time when 5 teams play, and then a late one on Saturday, and then 2 times for 2 games on Sunday. And that's basically their entire weekend. And it's very easy, and everyone knows what time the games are on, and it's very simple that way. They don't have to deal with time zones. It's all in one time zone. They don't have to deal with traveling and making sure that you travel 2 days in advance, because you have to get 6 hours of flight time out of your body in order to compete at a high level. And so, you know, I think that's something that really needs to be taken into account when you're looking at assessing MLS and the possibilities of a single table. Because ultimately, the other thing that people love to complain about is that the level's not as good as Europe. And so something has to give a little bit. And I think that a single table, the issue with a single table, especially if MLS pushes to 24 teams, as Commissioner Don Garber has said recently he wants to do by 2020. So for that to happen, you're going to have more teams. It's going to even bring even more travel if you have a totally balanced schedule and a single table.
Well, and Greg, I mean, part of that single table discussion is, I guess, the, you know, what promotion and relegation is and the unification of the soccer pyramid. Those are sort of the meta questions behind that. So, you know, again, for listeners, you know, what's promotion and relegation? Do you think we're ever going to see it in the United States? And how does that relate to our soccer pyramid becoming more unified?
Well, first of all, can we unify the soccer pyramid? The soccer pyramid is already unified. You know, you have very distinct levels. MLS is Division One, NFL is Division Two, USL Pro is Division Three, and then PDL, and then below that, even in the fifth level, is the NPSL, where my team plays, Detroit City FC. Soon, of course, be the world champion. I think we're going to start climbing the pyramid somehow.
Very nice, very nice.
Even without promotion and relegation, I think we're going to climb the pyramid. so, at least that's my hope. And promotion and relegation, first, let's you know, for anyone who doesn't know what promotion and relegation is, it's a system that exists in Europe and in South America in which the worst teams each season, basically, are sent down to the division below. And the top teams in the division below are sent up or promoted up to the division above them. So, for example, last year in the Premier League in England, one of the clubs that finished in the bottom three was Wigan Athletic. And Wigan were relegated to what they call the Championship. It's a little confusing in England because you have the Premier League and then the Championship and then the First Division and then the Second Division. It gets a little confusing with their naming. But basically, they ended up being relegated down to the second division. And at the same time, Cardiff City, finishing the top two, and they were promoted, I think top two, top three. I think there's a playoff in there as well, and they might have been the playoff team. But anyway, they were promoted up to the Premier League, and that's how it works. As to your question of could it work here in the United States, I think it could work with some caveats, namely the sense that it might work if you had maybe a Division One and a Division Two, and they were a closed system. Because, you know, if it's an open system, at some point you need to maintain a certain level of investment, a certain level of infrastructure for each club that will eventually get to the first division, or the top division, I should say. And so you need to, are there enough cities right now in the United States, or let's say even in the next 5 years, that have the wherewithal, the resources, and the infrastructure, namely, when I say infrastructure, I mean a stadium, that could handle being a top-flight club? And I would argue that no, there aren't. And maybe there aren't even the audiences for that. And so until maybe the entire soccer world in the United States and Canada matures a little bit more, I don't think that relegation and promotion is really a viable option, unless you go to, at some point, maybe a closed system of one and two, where there is promotion and relegation between one and two, but then you stop. Because then you can at least, you can look at the numbers, and you can say, all right, we have 40 clubs that can handle this. Because the U.S. is so much bigger than all the other countries. So maybe you get your 40 clubs that could legitimately handle being in the first division or the top division. That way, then, you know, you can go between one and two, which would be interesting. Obviously, it would bring that excitement of not wanting to be relegated.
Right.
Obviously. So that might be one way to go.
I guess embedded in that question is a sort of U.S.-centric view that we're supposed to conform to be like the rest of the world. You know, there's that big chatter recently when the United Soccer Council sent out that survey asking, how would you feel about switching to this new calendar? You know, I think the assumption is always we need to conform to how the rest of the world plays. And I guess embedded in that question is, well, of course, we have to go to promotion and relegation because that's how everyone else plays. And I think you've made some really good points about, well, if we did do it here in America, there are certain things that have to be in place. So,
yeah, and what's funny is that I actually think that it's that attitude that you talked about, that sense that we need to conform to the rest of the world, I think it's slowly starting to change. And I think that as people in Europe in particular start to recognize that maybe their system isn't the best one, and you start to see the globalization of the game now has people talking about the World Cup being played in the winter. Now, if the World Cup's going to be played in the winter, then MLS's schedule is perfect. Right? Now, of course, Europe goes crazy about that because it's going to screw up their schedules. But it shows that, you know what, the world is shrinking or flattening, whichever metaphor you want to use, and it's actually Europe that's going to have to conform to the world and the way things are changing. Because I can tell you, every big club in Europe, what they're interested in are the markets in China and the United States.
Right.
And so there are certain things that they're going to have to do to conform to be part of those markets. So maybe we're getting it right.
Well, you know, in some ways, you know, it's just the perfect time for America to grow up as a soccer country.
Yes, it is.
So I guess, and so another point you sort of clarified, you were asking, you know, we are already unified. I guess I should have made that a bit more elegant. Are we going to see more cooperation between? Because I think a lot of people were surprised with the USL Pro announcement. We thought, well, isn't the NASL supposed to be the second division, and aren't they supposed to be that natural partner for development? They're almost there, et cetera. Are we going to see more? Are there politics that prevent us from more cooperation in the soccer pyramid since it's already unified?
Well, you know, I think just like every other thing, there are always politics. And, you know, the politics in this one, I don't know all of the politics, but I can say that USL Pro and the partnership between MLS and USL Pro works out really well because arguably the NASL, so, you know, the young players in MLS, let's say, that you bring up and you want to get them games. And because of the salary cap structure that MLS has, the younger players and the sort of the guys down at the very end of the roster are guys who are not making very much money relative to other professional athletes, obviously, and sometimes certainly relative to some of their teammates. And so because of that, they might actually make more money if they went and played in the NASL. They might. But they also might not have the opportunity to be seen in MLS and all of a sudden get a bigger contract someday and to prove themselves at the top level. Now, because they're so young and they need to evolve and develop as players and as men, arguably USL Pro is a better place for them to go and do that because they're now maybe playing on par with other guys who are trying to develop as well. And so the coaching that's involved at USL Pro level can actually be tailored to trying to develop these players as players. In the NASL, they are, and rightly so, and you totally understand this, they're going to be a little bit more concerned with winning and trying to win the championship, the NASL championship. Whereas at the USL Pro level, you can really start to think about the development of players. So I think that's one of the main reasons why that partnership was struck between MLS and USL Pro. The second thing of that is that USL Pro is the top level of USL. So also within the USL is the PDL, where a lot of young players are coming through. And so that's actually the start of what you're talking about, which is that upward trajectory through the pyramid. And, you know, look, I'm with you, ultimately. Now we need to get the NASL into this as well so that it starts to really flow upward into MLS to create the best top division, and eventually to create a better U.S. and Canadian national team. And that's because, let's not forget, that those guys, those two teams sort of hover above all of this in terms of trying to improve.
Hey, Greg, this is Ryan out here in L.A. La La Land. Pretty big L.A. Galaxy fan, and rightly so with being the defending champions for 2 years here in a row. Just a little plug for my guys. Talking about the USL Pro, and I've heard some buzz about Bruce Arena and Chris Klein looking at trying to draw in maybe a USL Pro club team for the Galaxy out here. How much do you know about that, and how do you see that, you know, kind of affecting kind of how other teams in the league may go about doing this?
I've heard similar things, and I've heard similar things not only, by the way, with the Galaxy, but several other MLS clubs are looking at this as well. To basically say, so, you know, this year there were four teams that struck partnerships with MLS Pro team. There were several more teams that actually ended up loaning players out, although not within an official partnership between the MLS club and the USL Pro club. But I think that one of those things that I was talking about with the idea of the development of the player. So Bruce Arena and Chris Klein look at it and they say, we need to have a system or a situation where we can create LA Galaxy players. And, you know, the partnership that works so well between Sporting Kansas City and Orlando City, when Dom Dwyer, of course, was loaned out to Orlando, and you know, that worked so well to get Dom Dwyer some great minutes, and he obviously did very well in the USL Pro, scored all those goals in the final. But arguably, you know, Peter Vermees, the head coach for Sporting Kansas City, would say, now, has Dom Dwyer been developed in this year in the way that I need him developed to become a Sporting Kansas City player? And that's the question that Bruce Arena and Chris Klein, and several other presidents and technical directors around the league are looking at it to say, let me get a club. I can hire the coach. I can install the system that they're going to play so that I can get a young player, put him into that system down there, and so when he is ready to come up to the MLS club, he already knows exactly what our coaching staff expects from, let's say he's a right back. He knows exactly where he's supposed to be in every situation because the PDL club and the MLS club both play the exact same way. And so I think it's I think it's a wonderful sort of solution right now to get some young players some more time. And if they're both owned by the club, it allows you to maybe bring them up sooner. It seems it's a pretty similar model to baseball.
Yes.
And so I think it would be great. And would be,
yeah.
And it's also, by the way, there is precedent for this around the world. You know, Real Madrid's sort of reserve team, if you will, plays in the third division in Spain. So, you know, I think that some of the German clubs have, they own clubs in the lower divisions as well. So I think it's a great model, and I'm very sort of excited to see that some of the MLS clubs look very, very close to going out and doing it, including Dallas.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more there, Greg. You know, for like Galaxy with guys like Villarreal and McBean and, you know, Hoffman, they could definitely use some, you know, good playing time to get more experience. Kind of to circle back into the bigger picture of things, you know, with this tie-in with the partnership with USL Pro and the MLSL Reserve League, how do you see this kind of affecting this expansion? You know, is 24 teams going to be the limit with, you know, more guys and a bigger league of players kind of coming up and being involved? You know, is 24 teams the limit for the MSL, do you think?
What do you mean by the limit?
I know we're looking to expand, but if we continue to rise up good soccer players here in America, how far do you see this going out with bids like, you know, cities like in Orlando and Miami and, you know, Atlanta, you know, San Antonio, possibly St. Louis,
right,
at some point?
So the commissioner of MLS, Don Garber, has said that he wants to, and that MLS will expand by four more clubs, including NYCFC, but four more clubs by 2020. So he doesn't, you know, is 24 the limit? Man, that's a big league, and it would make it one of the biggest top division, if not the biggest top flight league in the world. Most of them around the world are 20 clubs, so that would make it a very, very big club, you know, and or a big league, sorry. And so I think that that's one thing that, you know, can it go beyond there? Jeez, I don't know. It comes down to, are there players to fill it in?
True.
And maybe that's what you were getting at with the question about development of players. Excuse me. Are they developing enough players that can fill in all those teams? That's the question.
Yeah, well, and when we think about those teams, and you're thinking of 24, and Don Garber mysteriously says, you know, three of the four teams are spoken for. We're not asking you to reveal any secrets, Greg, but, you know, what do you speculate those three are? And apart from Detroit, you know, Detroit City FC coming in as the fourth team, what's your pick for that fourth team?
Well, for the four teams, or the one that I think is the one, you know, I think it's a lot of the same similar names that we've been talking about. Obviously, Orlando City is sort of well on the road. They're talking big time about a stadium down there. The government is involved. So, that's one I think that is very intriguing. Some of the other usual names that come up. Miami, of course, has been talked about by lots of people. I think that Minnesota and everything that's going on there with soccer could be interesting. Obviously, Atlanta is a name that has been thrown around for years and years. I'm very curious about what's going to happen in Las Vegas now that they have this new team that just opened up that, by the way, has the greatest nickname in the history of sports. I don't know if everyone knows, they are the Las Vegas Mobsters. So I can only just imagine all the fun that they're going to have with marketing and stuff. So, you know, I think that those are them. You guys mentioned San Antonio. San Antonio's always in there. I would be interested to see what happens with some of the other NASL locations, you know. If the Tampa Bay Rowdies can continue to grow, do you go to Tampa Bay, or is that too close to Orlando? You know, I think that Nashville is an interesting place. They've always been a place where the U.S. soccer has gone and done pretty well. And so could you put a team there? They have a new club that's about to open up in Nashville called the Nashville FC, in its original name. But interestingly, it's going to be owned by the supporters. So that's sort of a different model as well. I mean, say what you will about the U.S. and conforming to the rest of the world. U.S. and Canadian soccer right now is doing a lot to just look at different ways to be involved in this sport. And I think it's really exciting time for all of us. But I think those are some of the big cities that people will talk about. You know, there is a massive city down in the Southwest that would be interesting as well, and that's Phoenix. You know, it's a city that's growing a lot. I know it's had some financial issues recently, but is there an opportunity down there with a city that's that big? Could that be a place for MLS? It might be hard to desert, but, you know, hey, maybe we'll change the way the whole schedule works so we can incorporate Phoenix.
Yeah, so sorry, I have a little question to kind of build on here. So, I mean, prior to Premier League being created back in 1993, the Football League was 24 teams in England. And now the Championship is 24 teams as well. But when they created Premier League, part of it was to kind of make it more competitive and not have, you know, so top-heavy and, you know, just kind of motivate people and making the league itself more competitive. So, if we here in the U.S. for MLS do the same thing to create 24 teams, do you think we're going to run into the same problem about parity and the distribution of talents? And, you know, are we going to run into the same problems that the Premier League saw back 20 years ago?
Well, I don't think we're going to run into the same problems with parity. I don't see parity as being much of an issue. It already exists, so... And in fact, when we were talking about that sort of competitive fairness, the parity is exactly what you want. You want teams to be on a level playing field, at least somewhat, when they start. And then they can start to differentiate themselves with youth development, better coaching, whatever it is, you can start to differentiate. You know, I don't think the issue in the size that you brought up in terms of is there a talent pool big enough? Well, I know that MLS has answered this question a couple of times publicly, I believe, when they've said, look, there is a talent pool big enough because our talent pool for soccer, of course, is the entire world. And it's just a question of how many international players you're willing to allow into your team. And so what's been interesting since 2005 when MLS started expanding again. That's when Real Salt Lake and Toronto FC came into the league. When at that time, league had 10 teams. Toronto and Salt Lake made it 12. Since then, the number of Americans and Canadians that are playing has obviously increased greatly. It has not, but you've also increased the international players. But it's giving a lot more opportunity to young American players to play. And that's a big thing I think that MLS has been trying to work on and has succeeded in many ways, to give these guys a chance, a place to play. Now, obviously, with all of the expansion, there have been 9 teams in the last 8 years that have joined the league. So with that sort of expansion, if you want to maintain or even improve vis-a-vis the level, you need to find a larger talent pool. So the number of international players obviously has gone up. And I think
I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead, Derek. Go ahead.
So do you think they're going to increase the number of designated players then to, or increase the salary cap to bring talent in from other teams or other nations, or, you know, to kind of become more competitive? Because, I mean, the salary cap, as I'm looking at it and how the league owns the player, is restricting the MLS to move forward more than anything else, I think, at this point.
Well, the salary cap is obviously a tight one, especially when you think about the fact that, the salary cap is roughly, I think, $3 million around there. So when you think about the number of the number of players in the world that make $3 million, it's pretty silly when you think about that. So is it restricting it from moving forward, right? Is it restricting it from moving forward in terms of competing with the Premier League, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm looking at it that way. I'm more thinking about, you know, let's take a player coming back, for grief, can't remember his name, who went to Seattle. What's my name?
Clint Dempsey.
Dempsey, absolutely. So the league technically owns him and pays part of the salary for him, and... then you're looking at someone like Kai Kamara, who left Sporting to go to Middlesbrough, and they kind of get money for him, but not really, because it's more like play money, right? It's not really something they can put right into, you know, like the European League. The team owns the players, and the teams are responsible for it. You know, couldn't you have a salary cap where the teams actually own the players and allow them to do more free markets in that way?
Yes, you probably could. First of all, the league is not paying all this money for Clint Dempsey, just to clarify.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the way a DP works, we should maybe explain, for what a designated player is for anyone who doesn't know. So MLS has this designation for certain players, which is a designated player, who basically can be above and beyond the salary cap. And so he has a certain salary cap hit, which I believe this year is 400 or maybe 350. I think it's 350, actually. And so he has that salary cap hit. The rest of his salary is paid for by the club. So the club can take beyond the salary cap, and they can handle that. What you're talking about, though, I think, is in terms of this sort of more free market. Let's think back to when we started the conversation and we talked about the league in 1995 and the architects of the league, thinking about what went wrong with the NASL the first time around. And one of the issues was this idea of the free market, and you ended up with the New York Cosmos being able to buy everybody. And what MLS is trying very hard to do is to not have a situation like you have in Spain, where the best clubs, the two biggest clubs, buy everything. By doing that, they are basically saying to themselves, we want to keep this idea that everybody can win. We want to keep this idea that it's a fair fight, because that's a sort of North American way of thinking about it. And so to do that, you need to maintain certain cost structures in place. And I think that you'll start to see over the next couple of years that some of the rules will start to relax a little bit, along the lines of what you're talking about, where it's maybe you open up some of the free market stuff. I think we'll start to see a little bit more of that happening. Not at the expense of losing that idea that one can win the championship on opening day.
No, I think that is very important. That's something that I think and I hope Europe is striving towards here with the fair play, which is kind of skewed, but it's still a step in the right direction. But I meant as far as here, you're still, if you allow your talent pool to grow and come from within, and you can create your own international superstars, you can essentially start creating a money train, right? Where
yeah.
Even if you can't afford to keep them here, you will start exporting players out to the club and the team, and everyone can invest that money and then to create even more players and more into the society as a whole. And that's what I'm trying to say. I mean, I think there needs to be a salary cap or one kind or another, or restrictions, just so everyone have a chance. So we don't create, you know, Manchester City or Chelsea or Barcelona or, you know, Real Madrid or any of these kind of super teams who just get the wealthy investment. But more like a team like Arsenal, who is extremely well ran because of how much they're investing into discovering youth talent and bringing them up. And
right.
selling them, unfortunately. But, I mean, you could essentially create a better soccer nation here by following the same kind of ideals that Arsenal runs by, or Ajax, or any of those other, you know, teams in Europe who really build, you know, talent from the ground up.
Yeah, so two reactions to that. One, the head of Arsenal, by the way, was the deputy commissioner of Major League Soccer for about 10 years, and one of the very early architects. So it's interesting that you looked at Arsenal as a good model. Well, he was the man who's sort of in charge of Arsenal. We all know Arsene Wenger actually runs the deal, but the man who's the business guy behind it all started with MLS, and he was there for 10 years.
Absolutely.
So his name is Ivan Gazidis. He's a very smart man and very well-respected what he does. So the other side of what you're saying, I think, is also very interesting because, you know, when you think about creating players and developing players, if an MLS team develops a player and they then sell them, all the money does not go to the league, just so everyone knows. Right? It's a small percentage that goes to the league, but the majority of the money goes to the club. And the club, by mandate, the club, and I want to make sure I get this right, so maybe don't quote me on this one, but from what I understand, the majority of the money that is made in a transfer deal for a player any sort of profits and stuff, has to be reinvested in the club. And so, you know, it could be reinvested into infrastructure, resources, could be reinvested into scouting, coaching, youth development, anything like that. But the money has to be reinvested in the club. So the idea of what you're talking about is actually true, which is if I sell a player, and I, you know, if I'm in Kansas City or something and I sell a player, I have to take whatever money I make on Kai Kamara and I have to put it back into Sporting Kansas City, which is a good way to both encourage a club to develop players and at some point sell them if it's the right price. But it also starts to help to build that club, build the infrastructure, build the development, build everything going on inside that club. I think, Tara, you're absolutely correct when you say the league, MLS clubs in general, need to start thinking about how can we start to create players and sell them. Not sell all of them, but if you create five, you can sell two of them, and then you can pay to create another 10, maybe. But the issue that comes up right now for MLS is that there's still a lack of respect for the MLS player by European clubs. And so a couple of things happen. One, either they don't come over here and scout MLS as much as they should or could. Or two, when they do come over and they find a player, they want the player to come at a discount. And so we use the American discount, which is, you know, you'd see a player like, just a good young American player. Even Clint Dempsey, when he first was going to go to Europe, there was an offer on the table from Charlton Athletic to go to Europe, and it was for something like $1 million. Now, Clint Dempsey, a player of his level, his skill, his ability, and what his proven track record was the first time when he was in New England, he was worth well more than $1 million, which is why they said no. 4 months later, a much better deal comes in, and he winds up going over to Europe. He came in for, I think, $4 million, and it was a much better deal, and the discount didn't apply, and he proved himself, and MLS, and more importantly, the New England Revolution, held out and said, we want a fair market price. And I think that now MLS needs to start standing up more and more to say we need a fair market price. Now, that comes with respect from the European clubs, which is still growing, because, you know, hey, Stephen, as you even started in the beginning, you said it's a small league. That mindset, that idea is still true around the world, that MLS is a small league. But it's growing. It's going to take time. And then, Per, I think you will start to see more clubs in that sort of free market starting to participate even more in that free market system.
So, Greg, I guess, like, in this free market system where we're trying to create a fair playing field in the MLS, it being out here in L.A., it definitely doesn't seem that way right now with, a, you know, kind of a second-tier Chivas team that hasn't really made its name yet, and or, you know, a Toronto up a little bit further north. What do you think will happen to teams like those that, you know, kind of where we have this, you know, dominant L.A. Galaxy team in the marketplace? So will there be, like, a get-rid-of status like your old legacy at the Tampa Bay?
No, I don't think so. I actually think that the way MLS is structured, you know, we sort of talked about this a little bit, the way of the structure of sort of diffusing those losses is so important in all of this. So you, you know, the problems that are going on in Chivas or in Toronto are all fixable problems. And part of that goes back to the idea of parity. But the other side of that is, you know, whatever losses are taking place are fixable and are diffused. So you end up diffusing those, and so you don't have this sense anymore, I don't think. And I think that the stability of MLS today, the success of MLS over the last couple of years has actually shown that you're going to have, you know, a team like Chivas does not need to be contracted the way Toronto and the Miami Fusion were back in the day. So.
Makes sense.
I just hope they get better.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe they might track some international stars that I didn't know it did well for the Galaxy, so. There's always that possibility, especially with a you know South American region being pretty close here, and their connections in there, they may be able to pull up some folks from Mexico.
Yeah, I think you know the success of Chivas and how that happens, it may not come necessarily with international players. I think what they need to do first, and I think that they are starting to do this, is just become competitive. You know, build a team that's going to just battle a little bit. Build a team that is then ready to bring in an international star. And I think that most of the time when people think about bringing in a DP or someone like that, you can't bring in a DP thinking it's going to solve all your problems. In many ways, a DP, especially when if you're going to get a DP, in my mind, you need to go and get a DP who's an attacker, a forward, a playmaker, someone like that. That player is not going to solve all your problems. You need to build a foundation. You know, it's kind of like you need the devil's food cake, and then you put some icing, and then you bring the DP, and it's like that sugary pink flour that goes on top of the cake. That's your DP.
Well, Greg is getting us all hungry for dessert now in the middle of the afternoon.
Lunchtime.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've got, you know, kind of one more question for you, and it sort of builds on this idea of you know, situations that have come up in MLS over the past decade or even longer, you know, with issues of contraction, expansion, salary caps, et cetera. With everything that's happened and the direction that the league is going currently, where do you think, you know, what do you think Don Garber's legacy will be?
Oh, man. You're going to get me in hot water maybe here. I think that Don Garber's legacy already is pretty solid in what he's done to solidify this league and then help it to really take off. If you look back to when Don Garber took over this league, it was 1999. He took over his position, and this was a league that was. It had had, like, a really good start, and then it sort of lost a little bit in the wake of 9/11 and, you know, the bubble bursting and the dot-coms and all of that. there were some issues with the clubs down in Florida. And I can't imagine how hard it must have been for the commissioner of a league who had spent so much time in the NFL to come to the decision to contract, which goes against everything almost that we believe in as a society of, you know, we're all about growth and we're about ambition and we're about, you know, just go and do it. And the idea of saying, I need to contract in order to survive is an incredible decision to make. But he took that decision, and in 2001, my poor Tampa Bay Mutiny and the Miami Fusion were contracted out of the league. And to then see it go about 4 years later, all of a sudden things had solidified a little bit, and he got some clubs, some new clubs. Toronto FC came in. Real Salt Lake came in. All of a sudden, this was a league that was starting to show some real promise. And that, I think, makes a huge difference. Huge.
Well, Greg, we've taken up a lot of your day, so I want to let you go, but I wanted to – I can't really have you on the day after the U.S. men's national team play here in Kansas City, and we have a dosa cero of its own, our own result here. Without asking you about how you feel about the wrap-up of this campaign, and if you agree with Jurgen's sort of realistic assessment on television that, you know, we, you know, I think he's sort of implying, you know, getting to the quarterfinals or the semifinals would be a win for us. And then just how you're feeling about this really exciting playoff run here in MLS. You were talking about parity today. That's a really relevant. What are your thoughts on those things?
Well, I'll start with your second question first. I think the MLS playoff race is going to be probably the most exciting one we've ever seen. It reminds me a little bit of the one that took place in 2009, which was just an astounding one. It came down to the final weekend, and everyone was sitting around their TVs and on a Saturday night trying to figure out what was happening. We sat there like minute by minute after each goal, trying to figure out whether someone, you know, does that mean this team is in? Who's in? Is New England in? Is, you know, is Columbus in? We do, it's a lot of fun. So I think it's going to be an amazing race. I think we still have now 16 teams that are in the running, or 15 teams right now in the running for the final nine spots. We should learn some things. I don't know what's happened in the afternoon game. I'm not sure if that had any bearing anyway. So I think it's going to be a great race down the for the playoffs. For the national team, I think that Jurgen Klinsmann has I have a lot of respect for what Jurgen Klinsmann has done in this qualifying. Let's start that way. Because what he did originally was to come in and say, I'm going to change the way this team plays. I'm going to instill some sort of, I don't know, this, we're going to play like we're Spain or we're Holland or something like that. And frankly, the U.S. just doesn't have the talent for that. And I'm not sure actually has the mentality for that at this point. Maybe someday, but not yet. And I remember I sat in a press conference once and I asked him a question. And I said, so, Jurgen, would you prefer to fail to qualify but feel like you have progressed the program in terms of the style of play, or would you like to qualify ugly? And he did not hesitate. He said, we're going to qualify ugly. This is the most important thing we have to do.
That's a good point.
And to his credit, he has adjusted the way he's played. And this team, you know, once they started, they went back to a 4-4-2. And maybe on a future podcast, you guys can explain, because I know you talked at the beginning about explaining the 4-4-2 versus the 4-3-3. But, you know, he went to a 4-4-2, and when I say back to a 4-4-2, traditionally American players have come up playing a 4-4-2 their entire career. In MLS right now, there are really only one or two clubs that play sort of outside of the 4-4-2 with any great success. I think to this day, the 4-4-2 is probably the best formation, the most successful, the most balanced for forwards, for attack and defense. And I think that our players in this
player pool as it stands right now are really sort of tailor-made for that sort of formation and for a style of play which is sit back, absorb the pressure, and then go like bats out of hell on the counter. That's one side. The other side of it, of course, is set pieces, getting on set pieces. And so I think this hexagonal has shown that we can be successful playing what I would call our American style. And I have a ton of respect for Klinsmann for recognizing that he needed to make an adjustment. And I also think that he owes Brian Strauss of the Sporting News a bottle of champagne for the article that he wrote pointing out all the problems that existed.
And that's when the good run started.
That's when the good run started. And I know Klinsmann is still sort of ticked off by Strauss, but I think he owes him a bottle of champagne for forcing them all to look at themselves a little bit and remember what they were doing and why they were doing it.
I think that's an excellent place to end our discussion. I want to ask you a little bit more about your film festival. Can you tell our listeners about it, you know, when it happens and where they can see some of these films?
You can see some of these films by coming to the film festival. How about that?
Great plug.
Yeah, Kicking and Screaming Soccer Film Festival. It's one of only three soccer film festivals in the world. There's one in Germany and there's one in Brazil. And we started it about 5 years ago. It's growing every year. We're having a great time with it. And it's in June in New York City that we do it. But we've also done some satellite festivals in various places. And next year we're going to be in Portland. We were in Portland last year. We're going to go back. This year we went to Austin, Texas for the first time. And so if you guys have any suggestions on where we should go, let me know.
Well, you know, we're going to say Kansas City, obviously, right?
Perfect. I love Kansas City, as long as I can get some barbecue.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find out more at Kicking and Screening. That's S-C-R-E-E-N, kickingandscreening.com, and find out more about Greg's project. You can also follow Greg on Twitter. Again, we said at Gaetjen. That's G-A-E-T-J-E-N-S. And, Greg, anything
yep.
else exciting that you're working on you want to tell us about before we let you go today?
Not really, but I encourage anyone who's listening to look up Joe Gaetjen and his story. There's a wonderful story written by a guy named Frank DeLappa from the from Boston Globe. I believe it's online somewhere, and it's a beautiful story about his life and his legacy.
And as we said, it'd be great for the name change to be Waiting for Altidore if this is the right time to switch over.
Well, he has to prove it next summer when he's down in Brazil and he scores a goal against the big nation. Maybe he scores a goal against Brazil to win it 1-0. I'll take that,
and then I will definitely
change the name.
That would be magnificent. Greg, thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you, guys. Thanks very much.
All right, we'll see ya. Well, guys, that was a really informative and awesome hour we spent with Greg Lawless. And he certainly stood up well under question. I think we just peppered him for an hour straight. I don't think we really gave him any time to breathe, did we?
No, I almost feel sorry for him.
He's gonna need to drink quite a bit of water here.
Yeah, he's going to get a water break. For those of you who are just joining us here on the tail end of our broadcast for The Beautiful Game on the AMDG Radio Network, our inaugural broadcast, I'm Stephen Heiner. I've been joined by David Avery, Per Lahti, Ryan Shea Horrigan, and our esteemed guest, Greg Lawless from MLSsoccer.com. For you who listened to our very first podcast, you're with us all the way here to the end. Thanks for listening. You can find us in the iTunes Store and on Stitcher. You would just subscribe to the AMDG Radio Network. The network has a collection of shows on current events, and pop culture, travel, and sport, of which we are the main representative. The season for the network is winding down, so our first 5 to 6 shows, which, as we said, are going to be this long form just for this season, we're going to try to lay the foundation for how we're going to approach future shows. So we're going to be doing this long format just for this season, and next season we'll switch over to a more regular podcast. format. If you like what you heard, you want to learn more, want to ask questions, you can find us at soccer@amdgradio.com. That's soccer@amdgradio.com. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thebeautifulgameradio, and finally on Twitter at @TBeautifulGame. That's the letter T and then Beautiful Game all together. Leave us ratings and reviews on iTunes. That will help our show get found more easily. And since it's a network, make sure you mention the name of our show, The Beautiful Game, in your review. Guys, I really appreciate all your questions and your time today. Thanks for being on.
Steven, thanks for organizing. Great
yeah,
show.
Absolutely. Yeah,
for our listeners, you're
going to...
Thank you. For our next show, it's going to be October the 19th, and we're going to have the man, the legend, Kartik Krishnaiyer, on to discuss the Barclays Premier League, which I know we definitely have some disagreement among the podcast guests about who's going to win the title this season. So you'll hear plenty of that. Join us next Saturday, and we'll also have a link to this show posted within our Twitter. Send it out to friends. Promote it. Let other people know, and we hope to educate you more and continue to educate ourselves. Guys, thanks again for being part of today's show.